Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of The Western Producer, your host for this week's show. A week ago, fields were very brown and very dry across the eastern prairies. Now, fields look wet and very white. Later in today's show, we'll talk about the recent snowfall and what it means for soil moisture in Western Canada.
Basically, we picked up in a lot of areas 10 to 25 to even over 30 centimeters of wet snow.
Mm-hmm.
And that should translate into, anywhere between 10 and about 35 millimeters of actual soil moisture.
Also, a livestock industry leader in Ontario believes livestock groups need to come together to deal with negative public perceptions and deal with the big issues facing the sector. And we'll hear from Karen Briere, a reporter with the Western Producer in Saskatchewan, who met Prince Philip when he visited Regina on a royal tour.
The Queen did walk right by me, and she smiled, and we were introduced as local reporters, and she moved along. But when the Duke came, he stopped right in front of me and asked which media outlet I represented.
Okay.
And so when I told him I worked for an agricultural newspaper, he looked, as I recall, very interested.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.
First up, about 40 years ago, it was possible to light a cigarette in your neighbor's kitchen and no one would say a word. It's hard to say exactly when that became socially unacceptable, but my next guest is worried that raising livestock is headed down a similar path. Mike McMorris, CEO of the Livestock Research Innovation Corporation in Guelph, Ontario, believes that public trust in livestock production is eroding and it's time for farmers to take collective action. I spoke with Mike earlier this week. Hey, Mike, thanks for coming on Between the Rows.
Hey, pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So you recently wrote an opinion piece in Farmtario, which has the headline, "It's Time for a Livestock Manifesto." Can you summarize and briefly explain the points you're trying to make in that piece?
I'd be happy to, but first I've got to give thanks to Manitoba, and I'm so glad that it's your show that's interviewing me from Manitoba, because I was inspired by the 2019 Manitoba Protein Strategy, which, as I read it, is recognition by industry and government that the protein industry in Manitoba is important and that there is a public commitment by all parties to grow it and do so in a responsible manner. So move over one province to the east and focus from protein generally to livestock products, and you have the guts of the Ontario Livestock Manifesto.
Okay.
So in essence, it's something that industry, government, and researchers would sign on to, and in a very public way, state that livestock is important to the environment, the economy, and the social fabric and the food security of Ontario, and that they commit to work together to grow it and to do so in a responsible manner.
Okay, so when you say we, who would be the we that would be signing on to this manifesto? Would it be like industry groups? Who are the different people coming together here?
So ideally, it would be the livestock group. So Livestock Research Innovation Corporation has as its members beef, dairy, pork, poultry, sheep, aquaculture, veal, etc. So those groups, so the livestock sectors, the government, so led in Ontario by the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs. And because of the structure of a lot of research funding in Ontario, in particular, the University of Guelph and its colleges, Ontario Ag College and the Ontario Veterinary College.
Okay. So I guess the question is, like, why? You know, why is this needed at this moment in time?
I'd say there are a number of factors. More and more, there are factors such like things like antimicrobial resistance, the whole arena of One Health, climate change. All of those and others are way bigger than one farmer. They're way bigger than one livestock sector. and they're probably bigger than the livestock sector in totality. So they're topics that really need everybody pulling together. So all of the groups that I just mentioned before. The other thing is we've got a consumer base that is facing more choices, and I'm concerned that they're getting more and more misinformed via social media. So I think to really have an influence on their own future, the livestock groups need to take action to make sure that they're relevant and the consumers see them for what the important part of society that they are.
Okay. So one thing in your opinion piece that caught my attention was, you know, you said that there was a time, say 50, 60 years ago, when smoking was socially acceptable. And then over time, you know, that changed. And sometimes when you're in the middle of it, you know, you don't notice the change happening. But right now there could be, you know, quite the change happening in terms of public perceptions of raising livestock, eating meat. You know, is there a chance that a decade or two decades from now that raising livestock becomes socially unacceptable?
I would argue that in some circles that has already happened, and that those circles are growing. I'm an optimist by nature, so I don't feel I'm being overly pessimistic when I think that livestock does face that possibility. The connection to the farm is almost non-existent, or is non-existent for most Canadians. And so they're really open to a lot of the misinformation that is out there. I refer to a book called The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. And he writes, and he gives lots of examples, like smoking, where change happened almost imperceptibly. And then it reached a tipping point and boom, the viewpoint of society changes. So smoking is an example of that, where I'm old enough to remember social gatherings where the air was blue. I remember when my first child was born, myself and some others smoked a cigar in our office. I mean, it might not have been by the rules at that point, but it was socially acceptable enough that we did it. And that type of social flip could happen around livestock, and it might sneak up on us. But there's another phrase that your listeners might be familiar with there. If they're not, they want to look up. It's called the second half of the chessboard. And so there's an old story of someone who invented chess and took it to their ruler of their country and said, "This is a new game." And the ruler loved it and said, "I must reward you." And the fellow said, no. And he said, no, I really have to. And the fellow said, "Okay, we'll put one grain of rice on the first corner of this chessboard. And as you move back and forth along the rows, double it." So he starts to do that. And he ends up about halfway through the chessboard and suddenly realizes that this is going to bankrupt his country. And it's a, literally a mountain of rice right that would be owing to this person. It's the same sort of concept.
Okay. So, you know, for quite a while now, I've been reporting on, you know, how farm groups, livestock groups in Canada are trying to use social media and other tools to kind of change their messaging, how they communicate with the public. In this case, are you talking about, you know, livestock groups and groups, you know, connected to livestock and the broader industry changing their messaging? Or are you talking about there's going to be a need to change some of their practices?
Both. So we need to do, we being the livestock sector, and, you know, the obvious focus here is Ontario, but I think it does extend obviously to Canada. We need to do a better, more consistent messaging across all sectors, because in many consumers' eyes, livestock is livestock. They don't get down to the distinctions between dairy and beef and poultry the way we logically do within the livestock sectors. And we need to do a good job of using all platforms, so that's social media, print, et cetera, et cetera. That said, if the livestock sector doesn't continue to improve and adapt, then it doesn't really matter what you communicate. You will be caught out on things you're telling that aren't true, and the future would not be good at that point. One of the things that really makes me think about this as well is that there's a rapidly emerging consumer choice around animal-free milk, eggs, and meat.
Okay.
So whether that's plant-based or cellularly based, consumers will have those choices, and that's here now, and it will only grow into the future. And those appeal to consumers for three reasons. As a consumer, they wonder, what do these products impact my health, the planet's health, and animal welfare? The fourth one that they don't talk about, that the reality beyond survey shows, is the cost. So I have to note that. But those are three things that the livestock sector, across all species, have to make sure that they're paying attention to: impact on consumer health, planet health, and animal welfare. So what do they need to do? They need to pay attention to those things and do a good job, tell their story, get better, tell their story, get better, tell their story, and keep repeating.
So just for the sake of drilling down on this, I mean, rather than kind of like fighting against the idea that the public believes that, you know, livestock and cattle in particular contribute to climate change, maybe you need to innovate, adopt new technology, and then kind of demonstrate that, hey, we are making improvements. The cattle and the way we raise animals today has changed, and we're producing less greenhouse gas emissions, and then demonstrate that to the public. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Exactly. And it's not a... We can't take a defensive stance that we're not the problem. Of course, livestock does contribute to climate change. Most things do. But if you can document, here are the good aspects, and here's what we're doing to get even better, that's what's going to win at the end of the day. One of the bigger challenges within that is that you're trying to communicate to an incredibly disconnected audience. And so becoming better at how we communicate that message is also really important.
Okay. I'll let you get in a little pitch here about your organization. Can you just explain to me what the Livestock Research Innovation Corporation is? Like, what do you guys do?
Sure. Thanks. We're a small organization started in 1993. And basically, we have livestock groups as members, and we have ministry funding, so Ministry of Agriculture, Food, and Rural Affairs. And what we do is help our members and anybody involved in innovation in livestock to do a better job. So we look at the innovation system of research and extension. And one of the descriptors that someone used for our organization that I really like is we're a trusted intermediary between academia, government, and industry groups.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Mike. You've been listening to Mike McMorris, CEO of the Livestock Research Innovation Corporation in Guelph, Ontario. Thanks for coming on the show, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Anytime.
Most Canadians have heard that Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, has passed away at the age of 99. My next guest actually met Prince Philip and chatted with him when he visited Saskatchewan in 2005 for the province's centennial. Karen Briere, a Western producer reporter in Regina, joins us now to share her memories of meeting the prince. Hey Karen, thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Did I get that right? You met him in 2005?
Yes, it was May 2005 during a visit by him and the Queen to celebrate the centennial, as you said, and it rained buckets that whole trip for them.
Okay. So what was the event, or what were the circumstances where you met him?
Well, during these trips, the royal couple did do media receptions, something that probably isn't done nowadays, I'm not sure, but this was 16 years ago, so it's possibly gone by the wayside. And we went to the Hotel Saskatchewan, to the ballroom there, and we'd all been briefed about how to behave, and so we were all just sort of mingling around, and we were told to stay in these groups, and then the couple would come in and kind of make their way from group to group and that sort of thing. But of course, as I said at the time, herding journalists is like herding cats. And so when they appeared in the doorway, this hush came over the room, and we all just kind of backed up and formed a great big circle, kind of forcing them to approach us, which was probably against protocol. The Queen did walk right by me, and she smiled, and we were introduced as local reporters, and she moved along. But when the Duke came, he stopped right in front of me and asked which media outlet I represented.
Okay.
And so when I told him I worked for an agricultural newspaper, he looked, as I recall, very interested and asked me about things like direct seeding and conservation efforts that farmers were undertaking. And as I recall, we talked a little bit about some of the crops that are grown on the prairies.
Okay. So as this is all happening and he stops in front of you, what was going through your mind at that moment?
I was hoping I was telling him the absolute truth, which sounds kind of ridiculous, but you know, I was a little bit tongue-tied and a little bit in awe. And hoping the words coming out of my mouth were making sense. But I know we did talk a little bit about canola, which I assume he knew something about since he asked me. And he seemed very knowledgeable about what was going on, which really impressed me.
Okay. So how long did this interaction last?
Oh, just a minute or so.
Okay.
I kind of got the impression he would have liked to talk more, but, you know, the handlers moved him along. But as we know from his work over the years, he is very interested in conservation, and he is interested in farming, and, of course, his son, Prince Charles, is also interested in the same things.
Right. So what kind of lasting impact did that, you know, brief conversation have on you? What sort of lasting impressions do you have of him?
I thought he was intelligent. He seemed very soft-spoken. His eyes, I think, were what made me think he's intelligent. He was very interested in what I was saying. It wasn't just like a casual, oh, you work for an agricultural newspaper, so I better ask you about ag kind of a thing. He was genuine, it seemed to me.
Okay. So last one, when you heard that he had passed away, obviously he's been ill for some time. What was your sort of reaction or emotional response when you heard about his death?
I was sad. I guess I was among those hoping he would see his 100th birthday this summer.
Okay.
And and it did take me back to that media reception. And that's my only brush with royalty, and likely to be the only brush. So it was very exciting.
Okay. Thanks, Karen. You've been listening to Karen Briere, a reporter with the Western Producer in Regina, who met Prince Philip in 2005. Thanks, Karen. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And now we'll discuss the big topic in Western Canada, soil moisture. Snow and rain brought much needed precipitation to the prairies this week, but was it nearly enough? Bruce Burnett is the Director of Markets and Weather Information with Glacier Markets Farm. He joined us now to talk about prairie weather and other news from the commodity markets. Hey, Bruce, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot.
It's obviously, everybody knows that it snowed. The question is how much, and will this make a big difference in terms of soil moisture for the next month or so?
Well, certainly, again, the soil moisture
has improved here from the snow, but I think it's important to point out that this is specifically for the eastern half of the prairie. So essentially east of Saskatoon, east of Regina, more so than western areas, which although they receive some precipitation from this, really haven't picked up an awful lot of moisture. So basically, we picked up in a lot of areas 10 to 25 to even over 30 centimeters of wet snow.
Mm-hmm.
And that should translate into, you know, anywhere between 10 and about 35 millimeters of actual soil moisture. Now, we've had some heavy winds with this. And although the snow has been quite dense and it hasn't, it has stayed essentially where it's fallen in a lot of areas, we have seen some snow drifts and that type of thing. So we've moved it around a bit as well, which again means that we're not going to pick up everything that fell in the fields. But this is a good start for spring moisture here. And it hits the area of the prairies that was particularly dry this year. So essentially, the eastern prairies had significantly drier than normal conditions through the winter, you know, in amongst the top five driest winters on record. So certainly this does help. I know farmers understand the value of this late season snow, but the problem is that in about 2 or 3 weeks after the snow is melted and farmers are back out in the fields, we'll probably be looking for some more precipitation because there isn't an awful lot of subsoil moisture out there.
Okay. So I was driving around western Manitoba, or I guess really central Manitoba, last week, kind of in the Glenboro-Carberry area. And I was kind of shocked as to how little moisture was around, like no water in ditches, no water in fields. Can you remember or recall a spring similar to this in the eastern prairies? Like, how far do we have to go back to have a year similar to this?
Again, I think you probably have to go back to the 80s in terms of being this dry in parts of Manitoba. Again, in the early 80s, we had drought conditions as well as the infamous 1988 drought. But again, every year is different, so you don't want to say that it's much the same. But these are quite dry. Those are years that we probably had similar levels of subsoil moisture along with a lack of winter precipitation. Again, it's good to see these snows because it's going to help us out here, but we certainly need to see the moisture pick up here as we move through planting here in May.
Okay. So let's just shift away from the weather for a second. And as you know, last week, the USDA released its World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Was there anything in that report that stood out for you or moved the market a little bit?
Well, I think if you were looking for a solitary number out of the hundreds of thousands of numbers that are in that report, or at least it seems that there's that many in those reports, basically it would be the corn ending stocks projection in the U.S. USDA dropped the corn ending stocks down to essentially 1.35 billion bushels, which historically speaking is quite tight. It's the tightest since, I think it was a 2013-14 crop year. So again, and that's coming off of the 2012 drought in the U.S. Corn Belt. So certainly, you know, they say a rising tide lifts all boats, and that's the case in corn, where we're also seeing wheat follow along, and even to some extent the oilseeds, especially although they haven't risen to the same extent, are being supported by this new corn projection. for Western Canadian farmers, I think the take home on it is twofold. First of all, the feed grains in Western Canada, be it barley or oats or other feed grains, even feed wheat, certainly it's going to provide some price support there because corn prices are likely to remain strong and supported here, at least until we get closer to the end of the U.S. growing season for corn. Certainly I think wheat gets a boost out of this. We're already hearing lots of reports of strong wheat feeding in the southern plains of the U.S. Because of the fact that they'll be soon harvesting their winter wheat crop, and a lot of that is actually going to go into feed rations because corn is so expensive right now. So I think, again, globally, this points out to the tightness in the overall feed grain situation. It is also interesting that the USDA did not reduce their Brazilian corn crop estimate. The corn, the second corn crop, or the Safrina crop in Brazil is under a bit of stress here right now, and certainly looks like Brazilian corn estimates are going to probably have to move lower. Of course, this crop is a bit of a bridge in the export market between old crop U.S. Positions as well as the new crop U.S., which is generally available more in the October-November time frame.
So that sounds all very supportive for wheat, and I'm thinking barley acres in Western Canada?
I think more so that it's supportive for barley acres. Again, farmers, I think, are looking to increase their barley acreage this year. For wheat, I don't think we're going to see an increase. I think it's going to be actually a decline in wheat area, despite the fact that we're seeing some relatively strong prices. And the reason is because we are seeing some very strong prices for crops like barley, for canola, for flax, for some of the pulse crops as well. So in that scenario, I think wheat area probably does decline year on year, despite the fact that we've seen very good prices here over the second half of the crop year. So it's certainly something to keep an eye on. If we reduce our spring wheat area in Canada, and then the acreage report in the U.S. at the end of March, they indicated a small decline in spring wheat, but I think that decline is going to become larger as farmers switch into corn and soybeans in the Dakotas. We certainly could see an interesting situation in spring wheat, especially if this dryness continues to cause concerns for the yields in 2021.
All right, Bruce. Well, that's something to keep an eye on. So thank you for your time. You've been listening to Bruce Burnett, Director of Markets and Weather Information with Glacier Markets Farm. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer. Thanks for listening, and best of luck with Plant 2021.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.